Hey, Blenders, on this week's episode, Gladiator 2 and Wicked are both hitting theaters, and we have John David Washington on to discuss his new film, The Piano Lesson.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Blenders, and welcome to episode number 330 of Real Blend, a podcast that wants to know. Kevin, you know Alfonso Cuarón's favorite song off the Wicked soundtrack?
Oh wow, I know what it is. Divine Gravity. I was literally about to say.
Nice job. show. big glicked energy here as we have both Gladiator 2
the BG
and Wicked, both hitting theaters this weekend. Even more important than that, John David Washington, friend of the show, is joining the program this week to discuss his new Netflix film, The Piano Lesson. So we have a lot of stuff to get to. Yes, sir. Yes.
Do you know John M. Chu's, the director of Wicked, his favorite not a surf song?
Oh, it's popular. Yeah. I do know that.
Do you remember Not a Surf?
Of course. Yeah. How can I forget? Staple of WHFS back in the day in the DC metro area.
Sorry, I had to pull that out.
I'm Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor at Cinema Blend and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast alongside Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago, and in the producer's chair, Gabe Kovach. Hello, boys.
Hello. Hello.
So we had a bonus episode earlier this week. It was Allison Shapker. She is the showrunner of Dune Prophecy.
And when that was a fun interview.
It was fun. Yeah, she's got a ton of great experience in television. Worked at Bad Robot on Alias and Lost and came up through the ranks on those. Yeah, and had a really good... You guys could go back and listen to that because not only is it like talking about the Dune world and sort of building out that stuff from Denis... films and a lot of stuff that they took from that, but I really found her conversation between having 22 episodes of a show back in the day and now distilling it down to 6 or 8 or whatever they end up getting to play with.
Yeah, there's also a really good throwback to the bookstore Borders in this interview because
Borders,
you remember Borders, and so she talks about a story about being at work, just going to Borders and writing what spec scripts or whatever, and then that led her to the show Charmed. And then from that point forward, kind of crazy, really amazing career. Like, but to start to be thinking that you're sitting at Borders writing spec scripts, and then a couple decades later or whatever, you're now, you know, you've had this incredible filmography behind you, and now you're working on one of the biggest shows out right now. It's amazing,
unbelievable. Wow. So go back and find that on all of our channels, and if you're on our YouTube channel, give us a like and a subscribe. Thank you very much. We're at youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast, of course, available. All the different places you get your podcast needs met. We've had a lot of really interesting guests. We have a number of really interesting ones upcoming. So you're going to want to make sure you keep it here because we're getting into some of the awards campaigns and a few people are coming back around to promote some of the films they've had coming out earlier this year. Giovanni Ribisi is filed away. He's the cinematographer of a film that I think is going to turn up on a lot of our top 10 lists as we do that at the end of the year, called Strange Darling. The boys got a chance to interview Peter and Bobby Farrelly for their new film, Dear Santa, and
let me
at length.
Quick preview, Peter Farrelly does an impression of Jeff Daniels on the toilet in Dumb and Dumber, and it is just wonderful. And
you didn't ask him, he just happened to put no,
he just happened to do it.
He just makes those noises.
That was cool to have them together, considering how big of a part of our childhoods and adulthood for Sean that they have been, you know? So.
I was retired by the time Dumb and Dumber came out. And of course, let's plug Real Blend Premium if you guys would like to get an ad-free version of the show and a newsletter every other week. Go to the description from wherever you are listening right now. There'll be information on how to get to the Real Blend Premium subscription. So John David Washington came on the show to discuss, is this his third time? We had him on with Nolan. Did we get him from Malcolm and Marie?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Just fits naturally in with the show. Great conversation. Loves talking about filmmaking and storytelling. And not only whenever we get him on, not only do we talk about the films that he's currently promoting, but he just likes going deep into other films that are out there right now. I think after you guys got a chance to finish with him, he asked if we were getting the director of The Brutalist, and it feels like he just wanted to like talk about that movie and hear more about that film. He's just a film lover, which I think is really cool.
He's great. And there's a obviously Tenet was such a huge movie for us. Jake and I had it as our number one that year. And it's so funny because like we've talked to him about Tenet before, and like even some of the stories he's told I've heard. But it was just cool to like, I don't know, geeking out with someone about working on Christopher Nolan's film. There's a really good video online right now. I don't know how to find it, but look up a video between him, Malcolm Washington, and John David Washington. Malcolm directed The Piano Lesson, which is the movie that John David's on our show for today to promote. And they're geeking out about John David working on Tenet and kind of Malcolm. I think Malcolm went to the set and kind of saw how it was being made or whatever. It just sounds amazing. And I love one of the my favorite things he says in the interview, which you'll hear, and he explains it, is that Tenet is kind of like Christopher Nolan's mixtape. Because it's like Jake has a great joke. It's like the real fans know. It's like you liked Oppenheimer, but I've been there since Tenet or something like that. It's like that one movie of his that is kind of forgotten in a way, but it's actually one of his. Even like people consider it like his worst film. I think it's one of his best films, but even his quote unquote worst films to some people are better than most movies that come out.
Well, coming out.
Nolan's worst movie is better than most directors will ever accomplish in their lives.
Tenet's like top four Nolan films for me. So
I mean,
it's like
his worst movie is Interstellar for sure.
Oh, don't even do the his worst movie is Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, that's probably true. I don't know if you know this. I got the invitation. I'm going to the Tenet set next year.
Sean, it already happened.
I'm so jealous.
Not yet.
I know.
I just pictured Sean rolling around in a hallway with Sean.
I know we got to get to we're going to get to the John David interview, but I know everyone's been looking at all the Nolan news recently, and we know that we've seen that Zendaya has been cast, Tom Holland, Matt Damon, Lupita Nyong'o. I'm really hoping it's a horror film. I don't
know. God, yes, please.
What you guys might know, but I'm really excited.
He's actually he's directing Tarantino's 10th movie. That's right.
Now that actually is a brilliant idea.
And then Tarantino's like, I'm never leaving. That was
actually really smart.
Is it really?
What if, dude? Could you imagine a Nolan movie written by Tarantino?
That'd be cool.
Like
again, that's the thing. Oh, this is a tangent, but that's the thing that people. Tarantino only wants to direct 10 movies. We could see Tarantino's words on screen.
Sure.
For a long time.
And this John David Washington interview we're about to toss to, he's so great. He was so great to come on. He did this kind of like last minute this week, and it's 30 minutes, and it really is just kind of a nerdy, like, I don't know, Jake and I texted afterwards. It just felt like John David, Jake and I could just be like childhood friends just discussing movies, because considering who John David's father is. No, what I mean by that is considering who John David's father is, the way he talks about his father's movies is like how we talk about his movies. Like he's just as much of a fan of his dad as we are, you know, so it's cool.
What's up, Gabe?
Before Sean's about to throw it to this interview, I wanted to give video watchers a quick disclaimer. No, it's okay. Kev had some technical issues with his camera. So he you can hear him just fine. You can see John David Washington just fine. Most importantly, you can see Jake just fine.
Correct.
But oh, audio listeners, your experience will not be very different. But just a heads up, you won't see Kevin's beautiful face during this interview. But
in true Tenet fashion, I have not recorded my video yet. Yeah, I'm going to go back.
Yes. 2030 is when we're dropping
the
video.
I'll do it next year. Yeah.
Kevin was going to find his hot sauce.
Yeah. Oh, he talks about that line. It's such a great interview. Well,
let's get to it. This is John David Washington returning to the Roblend podcast.
John David, good to see you. Thanks for coming back to the Real Blend podcast. Great to have you on, man.
Thanks for having me, fellas.
Of course, Dale, I love having you on.
You and I talk about movies a lot, and I do want to talk about just movies in general, obviously, because this is a movie show and people listen to our show want to understand the technical nature of how movies are made. And so obviously we'll dive into the piano lesson. We also want to kind of get into a scope of kind of this year in movies has been absolutely incredible as well. Yeah. But, you know, I've talked to you about this before. You've worked with some of the greatest cinematographers ever. I think about Hoytema on Tenet, but also Mike here with the piano lesson, who's really extremely talented. And I've always been curious to ask actors about their relationship to the cinematographer. I know some actors are really into the cinematography. I know Zendaya absolutely loves to know how things are set up and lit. But some actors don't think about the camera at all. They're really kind of in the zone as the character in that way. But having done this on stage and then now doing it as a movie, you do have a camera. And so I'm just curious what your relationship was like to the cinematography, having done it now as a movie. Did you think about the shots? Are you somebody who is obsessed with kind of that cinematography part?
I going into any project, I am curious about who's going to shoot it. And I'm very much interested in how the film is going to look. You know, I care a lot about story, but I'm equally as passionate and as inquisitive about what it's going to look like. What is the visual language that we're trying to tell in the story? And so knowing Mike G, who shot as you know, It Follows and Us, he has a sensibility of horror and genre, danger, and yet he's able to capture, at least in what I've enjoyed about his work, is human behavior in a way that's, he sort of gets out the way. Some of the best signs of a great cinematographer is how much they get out of the way. And but yet still leaving their imprint and their style on something. So I was going into it, finding out that he was shooting this, I got really excited. He likes black skin very well, you know, so I was all about that. You're going to be able to see our facial expressions and all those things. When I'm in it, though, when we're on set and it's happening after rehearsal and after talking to him, I'm not aware of it, or I try not to be. I like to sometimes in my off days come on and see how things go and ask questions. But on the day of, on game day, I'm usually trying to focus on my behavior.
As a quick follow up, like with something like Tenet, for example, the behind the scenes footage of like Hoytema holding that IMAX camera, right? While like, are you like, that thing sounds like a lawnmower from what I understand. like is that something, do you geek out about that at all?
Well, let's be clear. I geek out about all of it. I just try. Yeah. But like sometimes that's why I have to remove myself from set, because I'm like, I'll be caught up in seeing how they, oh, that's how we set up that. Oh, look how we lit that. Oh, wait, let me focus. But yeah, you can't deny, like, by the way, the star of the show is the IMAX camera. All right, let's be clear. And Hoyta does his own stunts, man. He was in there. I've told this story before. Like we were doing the hand-to-hand combat stuff in the hallway fight scene. At the hangar, yeah. And I'm like, I accidentally kicked him a couple of times, and I was like, oh, I'm sorry. He was like, no, keep filming. So like, and he jumped in with me on the turnstile. He like I hop in first, and he hops in with this big ass camera. It's like, it was really impressive. I mean, you can't help but you have to notice that, and I acknowledged it very much so. And but he again found a way to stay out of the way, even though he has this big ass machine, you know. But you also know it's one of those things. It happened a couple of times on Spike Lee's film when we did the double dolly shot. I just went crazy because you know what this shot is. You've been watching this your whole life. This is the moment. And it was one of those walk and talks in a Nolan film. He actually put it on a track, and it was just one of those. Oh, this is like what they did in Inception. This is the walk and talk. This is the Nolan dialogue and the walk and talk as it goes on. So I'm very much aware and geek out when special days and signature shots are happening for sure.
That's cool. I would love, before I ask my question, I'd love to follow up on something that, you just mentioned. Three of my co-anchors here in Chicago are Black, and you talked about the value of having a DP who can shoot and who can light Black skin. That's a very real thing that I feel like people need to appreciate, and I've been educated a lot by working with my co-anchors who are Black, and the value of having to bring in someone on our set who can who can light and so that we can shoot Black. That's a very real thing that I feel like even today in almost 2025 isn't appreciated enough in Hollywood, and to find someone who can do that is a very real gift.
And, you know, it's kind of a delicate, you know, subject, because you don't want to necessarily harp on it too much, but at the same time, it is the reality. A lot of, I did the film Malcolm and Marie, Marcel, shout out to Marcel. That was a big part of the discussion, especially being in Black and white. And since knowing that we are not too many folks that look like us, particularly or in films like that in the Black and white era. So we wanted to pay homage to that as well. And what Marcel did, I think it's not just knowing how to light certain skin, but there's a rhythm of the way they capture certain rhythms and cultural references and behavior is all a part of it. It's all encompassing. And it takes special, open artists to do. I mean, Marcel, he loves hip hop music. We had like debates about who were the best Wu-Tang Clan rap member and things like that. When you get, when you're able to, you know, to talk to your DPs and your teammates like that, I think they can capture you in a way that they wouldn't necessarily know how to if they didn't know you in that regard. Chase was the same thing. And Black Klansman, we watched, what was it? When we would watch films together, he and Spike and I, different like of what the genre of what they were trying to go for. And so like being able to have those conversations, I think, do aid in the the look of the film.
That's awesome. You know, so I'm shifting gears. I've got to tell you, I love my sister more than anything in the world. I'm not sure I could ever take orders from my sister on a movie set. If she ever said, well, why don't you do this? I'd say, well, why don't you just go to hell? And then I'd be like, then I'd call mom, and then that would be the thing. Jay. I'm curious, how difficult is it to separate your brother from, this is the man I have to listen to on set? Was there ever a moment where you had to remind yourself, like, wait, like, I can't push back. This is my brother. This is my director. I gotta actually have a conversation with him.
If I didn't push back on something that I felt like that needed a push, I would be doing a disservice to August Wilson. I'd be doing a disservice to him and to the entire cast. That being said, I didn't see him as my brother. It was a filmmaker that I've been following for a long time, you know, and got excited that he chose this to be his first film, to be his first feature. His ideas and what he wanted to do with the story is what's excited me. We talked about like the opening of this film, having ideas of flashbacks of like in Malcolm X, when we see Malcolm Little's father cut to, like, it's him preaching and then it cuts to him on the train tracks about to get ran over, like the violent disposition and of experiencing his father. We talked about like the way the house was going to burn up. We talked about the way Malcolm Little's house was burnt up. Like, so conversations like that, just knowing what he wanted to do and what I was hoping for it to get done, how it was going to get done, was very exciting. I'm talking to him as a filmmaker slash my brother in that terms, though. But we talk like that. My whole family, we talk movies. We do stuff like, that's why I was pumped up about doing this today, because this is what we do all the time.
That's awesome.
So, you know what I mean? So it wasn't like taking orders necessarily. It was a collaborative effort. It was listening to my director and a lot of times him allowing me, giving me space. He didn't really talk to me a lot in that time, in that regard. It was a lot of it was what he didn't say. And I like, not to make it a long answer, but no. I find that with a lot of these directors that I admire, Peter Berg, my first start, we did the pilot for Ballers. A lot of times it is what he wouldn't say, or he would come around the corner after a take one time and said, he gave it a pause and he said, "You're a pretty motherfucker." And then I just laughed. And then he left. Actually, right now. I was just different things like that. I've had encounters like that with these giants of directors that are just regular. I'm joking with Mr. Nolan about Wayne's World 2 before a take, or Spike Lee saying, "I love my fucking job. I love my job." Yell in action. I love that. That's the way of directing too.
Wait a second. Christopher Nolan watches Wayne's World 2?
Yo, we were quoting Wayne's World 2.
Not one, but two.
But two.
You know, why two?
Camera one, camera two.
Also, I don't know. I know people, you've talked about this before. You improvised the hot sauce line. And he was cool with that.
Yo, so like, honestly, he told me to do, see, I don't know if I'm supposed to, well, I'll say it. he was talking about, we need something there before I get hit and we start the action sequence. I was like, oh, okay. You know what I'm saying? And then at first the scene was set up where there's people are running, like staff members were running out of the kitchen. That was how it was initially set up. And so I saw like a couple cooks and some maitre d's and stuff. I was like, I ordered my hot sauce an hour ago, but I did it like really broadly. And he started busting out laughing. And Jackson Spadell, who's also our fight coordinator, he started laughing. I got two laughs, right? And then so, and he's like, I was like, after the take, I said, I'm sorry, Chris. I just was like, he was like, no. Let's do a tamer version, but keep the line. And then we worked it. But I love that. He embraced it.
Every time Nolan laughs, an angel gets its wings.
Yeah. That's the best line in the whole movie.
But you know, he's so specific with his writing and stuff. So the fact that, you'd be surprised, like Chris, at least in my experience, embraced doing takes differently every time. He embraced finding the character, like as you do. It's like he's hiring you because he knows what you'll bring, to the character. And that's what it felt like with a lot of these giants I've been able to work with.
Wow. You know, we're talking about at the beginning of the interview about cinematography. I want to use that question as a launching pad into the composers that you've been set to. Terrence Blanchard on Black Klansman, obviously. Alexander Desplat did The Piano Lesson. Ludwig on Tenet. You work in films, and I say this a lot on the show, where a score is also a leading character. It is a character involved in the atmosphere and the emotional connection we have. And I find it fascinating because as an actor, you generally don't have that score with you as you're performing, but the emotional experience that you must have when you finally see your performances set to that music, and specifically with Alexander Desplat here, obviously it's a very interesting thing that none of us will ever experience because we weren't there acting with you. You get to kind of, it reveals things I'm imagining to you about the work that you've done, maybe emotionally. Can you speak about these composers that have composed your scenes and kind of what that's meant? I mean, the Black Klansman score is one of the best scores I've ever heard. That score is an atmospheric part of that movie, you know?
Character. No, I mean, see, here we go, Kevin. See, this is what we do, baby. This is what we do. not to be overly dramatic, but I listen to scores on the day of the shoot of different, you know, so like Nicholas Britell, he's one of my favorites, right? He's incredible.
His Beale Street score, dude.
He captures the African American experience in a way that's like intergenerational. Like, where are you from again, Nick? Like, what the hell? Like, so I'll listen to, like, I got to, you know, Hans Zimmer scored The Creator. So I find myself, I'll listen to different scores. I put together score playlists for different characters. Knowing, especially on tougher days, on emotional days, that'll get me in a zone of where I need to be. But it's really what we do as an actor is we offer up everything we have, everything we can for the performers. And the editor and the director, they cut together a collage of the performances and put it together. Then they add the sound and they add the score. And it enhances the experience, not just the acting you're seeing, but the entire scenario that you're watching, in particularly in a particular scene. I think it's crucial. I think it's monumental. Some of the greatest scores on ever done. I've been in great moments. The glory tier, those high strings when Edgewick pushes in and you hear the high strings of that score. It's like it's a part of that. It's a part of that experience, which is cemented in our soul and my soul forever. So it's I love when I'm able to find moments of performances that are aided by a score. It's a great feeling. It's a great thing.
Do you have a moment in your filmography where you felt a specifically highly emotional element hearing your performance set to a piece of music? I mean, obviously you mentioned your father in Glory, but what for you, seeing you set to it, like what's that scene for you, or that moment for you?
Man, I'm not there. I don't know, man. I'm still trying to work it out. It's hard for me to watch myself too. So I know.
You're really great.
Yeah.
No, I mean, though, to Terrence Blanchard, like that like riff. It's so. It's such a part of the DNA of that story and that movie. I don't know. I'm just proud of all the scores I've been a part of. I mean, that the Ludwig stuff he's got going on, like he's really. I think he understood the script better than anybody based off how he expressed it through his sound and the sonics of it. So I don't know. I don't know if I have that scene necessarily. Let me get back to you on that, man. Let me text you that, man.
Text me later.
What's the score? You mentioned like listening to scores that get you emotional on set. What do you turn on from someone else's movie that gets you to the place where you need to be?
Well, like I said, I a lot of Nicholas Patel. Like I listen to he's operating on another level. It's kind of crazy. You know, John Williams, like Dances with Wolves score is for me. I love that score. I forget the composer's name right now. He did the Jonathan Demme uses them a lot. He was one in the score Philadelphia. I love that one. Grant Williams, who's an African American composer. I use them a lot for Amsterdam. I'm all over the place with it. A lot of different scores from movies that I just try to put together for a character. And it's That's interesting awesome. That I don't think about the movies that the scores are a part of when I'm working, because that's what we do with movies, right? And music, we make it our own. I connect it to my experience and what I'm going through. I take the train and subway a lot, and I walk a lot. So a lot of times when I'm listening to scores and music, it's related to what I'm going through at the time or where I am in my life. So I love that the art gives us that in that way.
This episode of Real Blend is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. What are your goals for the upcoming holiday season? Whether it's traveling internationally or connecting with family and friends, a new language can open doors to meaningful conversations and cultural appreciation. I myself have family that live outside the country, and learning a new language has helped me communicate and grow closer with them over the years. That's where Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program, can help you take those goals to the next level. Rosetta Stone has been trusted for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's designed for long-term retention with no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. And it's available on desktop and mobile, so you can continue to learn whenever and wherever is best for you. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Real Blend listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off when you visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
That's awesome. Yeah. Jenny, a movie set's obviously a very controlled place. You are surrounded by professionals and everyone's there to do a job. When you're live on stage, you are in front of several hundred X factors that you cannot control. You can't stop people from talking. You can't stop cell phones from going off. You can't stop babies from crying. When you were on stage doing this live, what was the worst thing that ever happened mid-performance that you kind of had to overcome?
There was a couple things. Coolest to the worst. When it becomes church and they start talking like, go ahead, say it, you know, stuff like that. That's actually kind of cool. Like, cause you keep going, obviously, but you also know, like, you're getting somewhere. They must be feeling it. Or the big laughs. Like, there's a line I say where, are we waiting till the people get up, right? I say it differently in the movie than I did the play. And every time I see, he's like about to have an aneurysm. He's like about to lose his mind telling his sister that. And we used to get a huge laugh where we'd have to take a moment for it to calm down. I love that. Some of the bad ones, though, were this dude in the front row just started talking and it threw me off. I had to, in the middle of my final monologue, I had to stop. And it kind of threw me off. And then I missed a couple lines and I kept going. It was like, that's theater. There was another time where they had to escort somebody out the back. There was like a big fight. And I'm like, it was in the middle of the scene. I was like, all right, is this the moment where I'm supposed to keep going? Do I stop and let that happen? I just, the show must go on. You keep going. And then we had a medical emergency where they literally just stopped the play. And that was crazy. It was like right at right towards the end too. So that was crazy. But that's theater, baby. That's what it's all about. And honestly, when a cell phone goes in, some actors don't play that stuff. They're like, who was that? Who said something? Who whispered? I don't necessarily care about that. You know what I mean? I mean, don't be rude about it, but you know, I'm if I'm rooted in the real life and in the actual situation that I'm in the circumstances that I'm in, none of that matters. Or I can use it sometimes in a way. If it's something's annoying and distracting me, let's see how I can infuse it into the decision I'm making at the time as the actor.
Wow. You know, one of the things that I'm sure you've been asked about is the film is dedicated to your mom. And I love that. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, I think it's just a powerful message in general. But can you speak to the power of that? Because the idea of Malcolm dedicating it to your mother, can you speak on that balance and the idea of the movie being dedicated to your mom?
Well, I love that Malcolm did that because it shows his relationship, which is, you know, different from mine with hers. You know, this is his offering to her and to everybody who watches the film to think about their mother. You know, I think he's making it communal in that sense. It's not just about her, but it's about all of our moms. For me personally, you know, because I'm not a director, every job I'm doing, I think about my mother. You know, the woman that she was before she got married, before she was a mother, she has a master's degree, you know, in performing arts. You know, she was on Broadway, off Broadway. She worked at a theme park performing. Like, she's been all over. This little Black Southern girl, you know, coming up in North Carolina, who took piano lessons, no pun intended, but actually did. Teaching lessons at 10 years old, child prodigy, all of that. And she kind of gave it up to raise her kids the right way. So a part of my joy in every day, why I love this so much, why I love talking about it, being all about this life, is knowing that what she was about before she had me. It's very much a part of my father too. You know, I knew coming up, it was about the artistry. And I, you know, it's like, this is what I've been wanting to do my whole life. So my passion for it will never subside because of those things. And I put that into every character I'm doing, so pardon me.
I love that. Jay, I want to swing the opposite direction. You've mentioned a couple of your dad's movies in this interview. I'd love to know, we all have blind spots. We all have like that really big, huge movie. Like, oh God, I just haven't gotten around to seeing it. I hope no one asks me about it. What is the biggest, most popular film from your dad's filmography that you haven't gotten around to seeing yet?
I've seen them all.
Have you really?
I hadn't seen. Oh my God. I've been on this Jonathan Demme kick lately. Like Philadelphia, I've been talking about it before. It's one of the illest movies of all time. Like that. And his performance, particularly Mr. Washington, it's almost like it didn't get, I don't know if he got the flowers he deserved for it.
He did, you know, not.
Tom Hanks obviously was incredible and he won and stuff.
Tom doesn't work without.
I don't think, exactly. You needed both. And his, like that character specifically, him being a Black lawyer, but on the other side of the LGBTQ+, you know, community, and working his way to understanding the community through the legal system while this is happening in Philadelphia, while he's a Black man. I'm just like, this is insane. Black lawyer, you know, it's I think it was a year after the OJ trial. Like it was just so much that was going on in that film. And, you know, when you get a Jonathan Demme close up, you know what I mean? That's like the actor's dream. And then he came into a wide shot when he's addressing, let's talk about what this film is really all about. The general public's hatred, our loathing, our fear for homosexuals, like that whole thing. And then the score, the strings come in. It's like, oh my God, the moment in the culture is happening right now in this moment. Jonathan Demme captured. So that's one of them that's just like not talked about, his performance particularly.
The way you get excited talking about cinema is everything. And
you really should just join the podcast by this point.
Let's go. Let's go. I mean,
but the access, what I find interesting about this is like, you're talking about these movies like we talk about them, and this is your father you're talking about.
Yeah,
and do you stop and ask him questions about this stuff? Like, do you like, hey dad, I'm watching this movie right now. What do you remember about shooting this scene? Like, do you geek out about that stuff with your own dad?
I have, especially in my younger years. I mean, I you know, he's a hero of mine. Like he was literally a superhero. When I got a childhood memory of him playing the trumpet during Blow Better Blues. I wasn't allowed to watch that movie till I got older, but I remember him bringing the trumpet home. You know what I mean? So, you know, I asked, like, he told me this story about, I think it was during a take or rehearsal in that film, Philadelphia. He did like a cartwheel, like in the middle of the courtroom. And Jonathan Demme, and he said, this is what he loved about Jonathan Demme. He said, I love that. He responded, he's saying, okay, that was interesting. And he was like, I'm not going to really do that, Jonathan. I just wanted to see if you trusted me, if you were going to let me, you know, stretch my wings and all that. And Jonathan Demme didn't blink. He's like, of course I trust you. That's the whole point of the hire. So little stories like that were so cool. But, you know, I've been able to talk to him. He shared some stuff before. Spike has shared some stuff with me, though, too. Sam Jackson, he shared some things with me as well. I mean, because he knew August Wilson. You know, he's had experience. The monologues were changed every night. They were doing it at Yale Repertory in 1987. I can't even imagine that, because these are like 12-page monologues, right? The play. And they were changed nightly. So I soak that stuff up every time I get a chance when I get with these great actors.
Yeah,
crazy.
Man, you're talking to two guys who named Tenet the number one film of the year whenever it came out. You know how much we love that. It came out at a weird time. It was the first big movie to make an attempt to bring people back to theaters during the pandemic. Is there any part of you that, because I wonder this, that wonders what the Tenet experience would have been like if it had just come out today?
Oh, I need to be. We got to talk off camera with that, because it's emotional. Because I don't know if I can. I love the fact that Chris, Mr. Nolan, Emma, they believed in it so much that they still wanted to put it out. You know what I mean? But it is like one of those. It's almost like his. It feels like sometimes. It feels like his underground, like, hip-hop album, like the one that did the full studio release, you know what I mean? Like, this is a mixtape, you know what I'm saying? Like,
that's what... you like Oppenheimer? I'm a true fan. I like Tenet.
Well, see, there you go. It's not yet.
It's so true. It's so true.
Like, you know what I mean? So that's what it feels like sometimes. But like, a real fan knows, like, this. So I don't know. In some ways, I felt that way about the creator as well. Like, it's one of those, like, that album didn't get seen necessarily properly rolled out because of the strike and the timing of it. But, like, sometimes people on a train, for example, in New York will say, like, you know, it's the way they say it too. Like, you know, the creator, I loved it. And it was like, wait, what? I think I know what you mean, but damn. You know, like, because, like, it wasn't rolled out or seen properly, I guess, or something like that.
But then, okay, to follow up on that, and it's so funny because that was actually one of my questions I had written down. I'm still having people come up to me who are still discovering the creator. And we've been so lucky enough to have had Tom Hanks on the show a few times. And he talks about the value of time with movies. Then listen, like, reviews are one thing. Box office is another. But if you made a movie and years later, I know it's been a year for the creator, but that people are still discovering it and talking about it. Isn't that the win?
Honestly, it makes me feel really good. Whenever they come to it, whenever they get to it and they see it and then they feel enough about it that they want to speak to me and say something, I'm with that. Yeah, we are in show business. So they look at, you know, how it did in box office and your career could sometimes ebb and flow based off that, because the studios or whatever, what have you, reviews, whatever, what have you, nominations help, whatever, what have you. But ultimately, if the movie sticks to you like movies have stuck with me, then that's the win. You know what I mean? When I get to geek out with folks like y'all, like, that's what it's about. You know what I mean? But ideally, you would like it rolled out and received properly at once and all that. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, if it has legs, to Mr. Hanks's point, then I'm with that. Yeah. As long as you have me, that's the name of the game anyway.
Yeah. So this is a question I've asked before that I find interesting. And you're obviously a huge movie fan. Do you know the movie you've seen the most in your life?
That's a good question.
I don't know the movie. No, it maybe. Okay. Like, maybe if I categorize it, so I can say I've seen sports wise, like sports films. If I think about sports films, I think I've seen, the documentary now, so Hoop Dreams, probably the most.
If Chicago.
Not that, you know what I'm saying? If not that, it's between Hoop Dreams, Mighty Ducks, the first Mighty Ducks, and honestly, Any Given Sunday. I think I've seen Hoop Dreams the most, though, because I had a serious run, like, when I was a kid. I used to watch it, like, daily. I had the VHS. And then, but then I had a run, like, listen, maybe around 12 or 11 years old of Searching for Bobby Fischer. I actually taught myself how to play chess through that movie. Like, movies, I'm telling you, this is my life, dude. I love this stuff. And then Lawrence Fishburne, you know, the way he taught, he had his different style from the other teacher. And then, but then Any Given Sunday was the first time. Well, actually, I got to say Friday Night Lights first. Peter Berg nailed, like, the Southern Texas high school experience. But what what any given Sunday accurately nailed the professional sports experience. And what he did was, to me, was revolutionary, was put Cameron Diaz as the owner, put a woman owner, like that dynamic, she and Al Pacino, I love that film.
Is that your favorite Stone?
Huh?
Is that your favorite Stone?
Dare I say, and I love the war one. Shoot, I'm drawing a blank. That's a great score.
Platoon.
Platoon. Great score, by the way. But honestly, I think I've definitely seen Any Given Sunday more. Yeah.
So as a quick follow-up, you mentioned Any Given Sunday. I know you played football, and I would argue that movies are kind of like football in a way where you have the coach is the director, and you're trying to, and with the clock running out, it could be the light or the sun going down. I feel like there's a lot of psychology that you could almost play into the idea of how a football game runs, and you have the, you know, the actors and the characters and also the players. Do you see a connection at all to kind of the way a sport like football runs and how a movie runs?
All the time. In fact, unfortunately, my inherent paranoia has also traveled from sports to so like in the NFL, they'd have tryouts every Tuesday. You can get cut at any moment. I saw somebody week 16 get cut. So I don't care what number I am on the call sheet. I'm always thinking about, hey, they can always cut you and cut around you. I know about people at table reads having the job and not having the job after a table read. You know, I love the team chemistry like this. You can be from different walks of life, different political views. I play with racist folks and they come together and for the common goal, and they see past all that, and you can evolve in that way. But honestly, to be truly honest, the contact sport of football is more comparable to stage. That every day, like, oh, wow. I fractured my ankle before our previews. So I was out there limping around and like dragging my ankle around during previews. We didn't even open yet. And
you make that like part of the character?
I had to, dude. Like, and you know, you had to make it like some of your, like, he went to prison. So maybe, and what would happen was, it was a miraculous thing that something about the boards heals you. I wouldn't feel the pain when I was on the boards. It just, as soon as I get off the field or get off the stage, that's when the pain would happen again. But you go with it. I've been sick. I thought of the flu game because I told myself, I'm not going to miss one show. I'm not missing one. I'm going full. And it felt like flu game, Michael Jackson.
Yes.
Michael
Jordan.
Like the last weekend, we had three more shows left. And I know I didn't test. I tested it. COVID, they said I didn't have it, but I knew I had something. It was bad. And I didn't have anything left, but I left it out on stage, but you use it, you work through it. So to me, that was more like playing with broken ribs or playing with a concussion or playing with whatever was the stage, because of the beginning, middle and end, no stopping.
Oh, man. Wow. We're going to get you out of here on this.
That's cool.
You've done something a few times in this interview that actually reminded me of an interview I had with your dad. One time I started out an interview with your dad and I said, you know, Mr. Washington, it's an honor to see you again, sir. And I got about halfway into my question. He stopped me. He goes, I appreciate that you said Mr. Washington. I appreciate that you said, sir. In this interview, you referred to Tom Hanks as Mr. Hanks. You referred to Christopher Nolan as Mr. Nolan. I'm curious, is that a trickle down from your parents? I know we talk a lot about like the professional impact that your parents have had on you, but those little things of just referring to someone as sir and mister, that feels, having had that experience with your dad once, that feels very reflective of you being raised by your parents.
That's a big upbringing thing. In fact, I don't want to give my parents all the credit. I got to give some to my uncle and auntie in North Carolina. My cousins were always yes, sir, no, ma'am. And being a kid from LA, from the Valley, it was so strange. Kids I went to school with didn't say that. But when I get to the South, when I get to North Carolina, my cousins and all them would. And I just started saying it more and more. And then, it was always about the please and thank you. But then also when you get to into these spaces that we're in, I geek out just like y'all do. Like when I saw Tilda Swinton last night, who went crazy. I was like, oh my God. What's even crazier is they know who I am. You know what I mean? Like, like, yo. So I'm always like, yes, Mr. Hanks or Mr. Nolan. It took me like weeks for me not to say Mr. Nolan, just to call him Chris, you know what I'm saying? Or Mr. Lee or whatever. Like, but because also like these people helped raise me in a lot of ways, man. I grew up on their work. So it's just the ultimate sign of respect. It's just natural for me.
Oh, Kevin, I always tell this the same, because we have the same experience. We both sat in front of Sir Anthony Hopkins one time, and Mr. Hopkins, I think we referred to Mr. Hopkins, and he goes, call me Tony. And we both went, No. That's not that kind of.
Trying to be disrespectful, but no, absolutely not.
My mom, I'm from the South, both of my parents would pop out and right in the back of the head.
I never told you this, but the first time I ever interviewed you was for Tenet.
And I, before that you came up on my screen, I was already going to call Christopher Nolan Mr. Nolan, but I was like, is it weird if I call John David Mr. Washington? Yeah. And when I did the interview, I said Mr. Nolan to Mr. Washington. I'm like, does that strange for him to hear me call you Mr. Washington? I always wanted to know if that was
Hell yeah, Kevin. Like, yeah, don't ever in life ever do that. No, I'm not there. You know, maybe one day we can get there. But I'm not Mr. Washington,
right? That was the first. But I didn't know how to be like Mr. Nolan. Oh, and John David. I just didn't know how to separate.
You funny said because I do remember that. And I was like in my head, I was like, oh, I see. I probably would have done the same thing. He didn't know. It's because it's Chris, right? It's Mr. Nolan there. Like, I get it.
Because it's weird to because you don't want to ever feel like, well, I don't like you don't. One person deserves that respect, and the other person doesn't deserve that respect.
Honestly, though, there are levels to it. It's Mr. Nolan we're talking about. So I don't know. I'm not a, you know, I wouldn't have been offended. I get it. You know what I'm saying? So,
well, dude, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone check out The Piano Lesson on Netflix this Friday. It's streaming on Netflix and then limited theaters right now across the country. Directed wonderfully by your brother, Malcolm Washington. It's really a remarkable film. I didn't get to see the stage show. So now I just feel lucky that I got to watch it in the movie form, in the cinematic form. You're always a pleasure to talk to, John David.
Love this, guys. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. If you want to join the podcast, you're more than welcome.
Yo, it'd be like the Green Ranger, like every couple episodes.
Dude, we'll have you on anytime, man. And stay safe, and I hope you have a good holiday, man.
Thank you, too. Happy Thanksgiving. All right, thanks, guys.
We have to thank a friend of the show, John David Washington, for coming on. We sincerely hope that we continue to get him on. I just want him to come on the regular every couple of months, punch in, talk about movies, catches up with what he's doing.
I think I pitched this to Sean. I'm going to publicly pitch this to all three of you. I think it would be fun if we could work out John David Washington being like a correspondent.
Yeah.
And just like he
just checks in.
Yeah, he interviews the director of The Brutalist for us. Like, we just get it. He just sends us footage, a Zoom recording.
That's good. Dude, like, what's great about him is like he'll text me and he'll say, "I just saw this movie," and then he'll say, "Let me know when you see it," and then we'll have a conversation. Like, I'm seeing Brutalist Monday. He's like, "Text me afterwards. We have to get into a whole discussion about it." I'm like, he just wants to geek out about movies. Yeah. And and it's cool because the way I love the way he talks about it. And like, it's so funny because sometimes I hesitate, and Jake and I think in this interview, we handled it well. You don't want to focus so much on his father because obviously his father is so famous. But at the end of the day, like when you, as you heard in the interview, he's just as much of a fan. Like, he's watching, what did he say, Jake? He's watching Jonathan Demme's filmography right now.
Jonathan Demme.
So he just did, was it Philadelphia, right? Mm-hmm. Is that Jonathan Demme, Philadelphia? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, and he's watching these movies and, you know, and then can you imagine that he's like, "Hey dad, remember how you shot this scene? Like, what was going on in your head?"
It has to be surreal. If your father's Denzel Washington, it has to be surreal.
Yeah, but he's cool about it.
Odd too is that like we're in the middle of an awards ceremony and Piano Lesson is getting some conversation and Denzel is getting conversation, you know, for Gladiator 2. So,
and like, Denzel's involved in Piano Lesson. He produced it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's a topical conversation.
He also produced the director and one of the stars, right?
Yes. Yes, he did. Indirectly. All right. So I have not had a chance to catch up with Piano Lesson yet. The screening that they had here in Charlotte was during Savannah Film Festival. So I missed it. So can you guys just give me reactions to it, Jake? Yeah. How is the film? It's August Wilson play.
Yeah, I got to say, I mean, ever since Fences, I've really had a soft spot for these August Wilson adaptations. Okay. I really loved Fences, really loved Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And I think, you know, I think this one, you know, Piano Lesson fits right in there. You know, it really does feel just like an incredible showcase of some truly amazing actors. There's some really great sequences that break out of the confines of the house that I think is probably the set for a majority. I have not seen Piano Lesson on stage, but it did not feel maybe as confined as maybe some people felt that Fences was. You know, Fences was predominantly, you know, the house and the backyard, right? Mm-hmm. This one... It is a lot in a singular location, as you could expect for a play adaptation. But I also felt like there was a lot of the world that was explored outside of that. You know, it's everyone kind of it's such a cliche at this point, but understands the assignment. But I also, too, I appreciated this movie for a thing that I feel like we don't do enough, which is appreciate how great of an actor Samuel L. Jackson is. Mm. I feel like these days we so often see him, you know, in the Marvel world or, you know, showing up in movies that remind us that we like him as a person. Yeah. And we like sort of the Sam Jackson persona. But, you know, Sam Jackson did a Piano Lesson on Broadway for a very long time. You know, I think we often forget he is a really fantastic established stage actor. He is outside of the persona of Sam Jackson. He's a brilliant actor. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is the first movie in a while that really, truly reminded me of how great of an actor he is. That's maybe great. Honestly, like, I remember having that same feeling whenever I'm of the belief that he gave the best performance in Django. I was a huge performance or a huge fan of his Django performance.
Interesting. Okay.
And so a showcase for brilliant performances as August Wilson adaptations tend to be. Denzel came very close to winning Best Actor for Fences, as did Chadwick Boseman for Ma Rainey. Mm-hmm. That, and I think that's one of the many reasons I appreciate these adaptations, is they're basically just setting the stage for just brilliant actors to do brilliant things. Because when you give them August Wilson material and a director who knows how to structure it, and you attach the brilliant actors to it, it takes actors who are already great to that next level, as we've seen with all of their works. And honestly, like, it seems like they're just going to keep doing these things, to which I say, go for it. Like, I know we talk a lot about the MCU, but give me the August Wilson cinematic universe. I'm here for it.
Yeah, it's on Netflix, right? Is that where it's available?
Yep. Yeah. All right. And Kevin, it had a limited theatrical run. Sorry, I'm going to cut you off. It had a limited theatrical run. I think it started in early November, and then the streaming is the release today, which is actually, the day this is coming out on Real Blend. But it's funny because, like, Piano Lessons coming out and streaming today, and then Gladiator 2 is also coming out in theaters today. And Denzel Washington produced the Piano Lesson. Obviously, the director is Malcolm Washington, his son, and John David Washington's the star. I want to shout out Danielle Deadwyler, because I think she is one of the greatest actors working right now. I still think about Till. And I think that she is a powerhouse. And in this film, this is really her movie. I mean, at the end of the day, the movie is about two siblings who are kind of fighting over this piano that's been part of their family for years. And John David's character wants to sell it. Her character wants to keep it because of the nostalgia and the history behind it. And one of the most powerful scenes I've seen this year, which you can kind of see in the trailer, happens at the end of the film, involving the piano and her character. And the piano itself is a character in the film. It's almost in every shot. It's just looming there in the background. It's a source of drama and tension. I think Malcolm Washington does a great job. It's scored by Alexander Desplat, who's obviously an incredible composer. The gentleman who shot it, Mike G, he shot It Follows and Us. So it's really well done.
Nice.
And John David, I think, is just an incredibly almost underrated actor. Black Klansman was remarkable. And I loved talking about that in the interview with him, because he got to do the double dolly that his father got to do. You know, for people who don't know, that's the shot where the actors look like they're floating.
Spike's signature shot.
Yeah, it's double dolly. I always think the best one, I love the one in Inside Man. The Malcolm X one's probably the best. But the one that John David got to do in Black Klansman is incredible. But back to Piano Lesson, Jake's right about Sam Jackson. Just really, truly an incredible actor. Michael Potts is amazing in the film. Ray Fisher, he actually is very good in the movie as well. And because I think the only thing I'd really ever seen him in is the Justice League film. So I was kind of, I was blown away by his performance as well. But yeah, I thought the film was really well done. And I felt like I got to see what the stage production would have been, but in a cinematic way. Nice. But Danielle Deadwyler is really, to me, the breakout of the film. I think that it's her movie. I think that she has the scene in the film. And I hope that she gets more work. Yeah, because I know that she, you know, I don't know that she's that famous. I don't think a lot of people really know who Danielle is. Mm-hmm. From, like, you know, she's not like, you know, she's not at the level of like Sam Jackson or you know, any like these major A-list actors. She deserves to be up there. I think she is brilliant. And I really hope that she gets some recognition, because I think she deserves to be in the Oscar consideration for this film. So okay. I loved her. Yeah, cool. She really is amazing. And so is John David. So,
all right. So check out The Piano Lesson. And again, thanks to John David Washington for coming on the show. So we have massive, massive movies coming to theaters that theoretically, when you look at the release calendar from now to the rest of the year, could be playing out, you know, as sort of a slugfest back and forth, just figuring out which one's going to perform better than the other. Let's start with Gladiator 2, a film that is, what is it, 20 years in the making? Is that
24. How long
it's been 25. Since?
25 yeah. years in the making? Okay. Ridley Scott coming back to the franchise. Connie Nielsen also returning. Other than that, fresh faces. The lead is Paul Mescal. And we won't get into spoilers for this talk.
Paul Mescal, just to
Paul
clarify.
Mescal? Is that how
yeah, I thought it was Mescal too, so, but apparently yeah, it
just,
is Mescal.
Just, and we could potentially cut this depending on what Gabe thinks. And I bring this up because I've gotten a lot of flack in the comment section on one of my YouTube videos for talking with Connie Nielsen about who is Lucius's father in the film, which is Maximus. The bar, I don't know about you guys, the bar I always use is if it's in the trailer, it's fair game.
Right.
It is all yeah, over the trailer about taking your father's sword and taking yeah. your father's strength. And so I
they literally have
openly,
a video of a kid.
Yeah.
And they say it's Maximus's son. And then yeah.
I've very openly been talking about it. If that's the spoiler you were potentially discussing, Sean. That's,
no. I mean, I will just say here, like, as a policy, I think that we generally do here on this show, for anyone listening, trailer is fair game. And if you don't want to watch the trailer, when you get to an episode and there's a review and we say it's spoiler free, but trailers are fair game. Like, if you were someone who wouldn't want to watch the trailer, I would expect you to not listen to this section until you've had the chance to see it. So I think it's fair. I mean, you're going to get flack in YouTube comments for anything. I don't know what to tell you about that, but no. It's in the trailer. It's yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
The entire arc of the story is that he's Maximus's son and he's back and now he's in the Colosseum doing the same thing his father did. And there's literally a shot in the trailer where he goes to grab, he wears Maximus's outfit and sword. It's in the trailer.
Yeah, it's in the trailer. All right. Yeah. So that's a great place to get into my reaction to Gladiator 2. I just saw it last night. We're recording this on Wednesday. And to me, it's a very soft positive. Like it's right on the line for me and a little bit over. And the things that push it over are production values and a couple of the performances. But I don't think it's very different from the first movie at all. I think it's extremely beholden to the first movie.
Derivative.
And doesn't do anything to distance itself from the template of the first movie whatsoever. So to me, I don't want to do this. You know, you want a situation where it's like Alien and Aliens, right? They're completely different entities and they live in the same world, but another filmmaker stepped in and figured out what to do something completely different. To me, this is just Ridley going through the same beats, essentially, but having more money to spend on them and coming up with bigger sequences. So the battles themselves are enhanced, you know, and as you've seen in some of the trailers, some of them involve flooding the Colosseum with water and having big boats going after each other. There are big battle set pieces, of which Ridley is one of the best out there to do these. And we've seen him in countless films over the years. But quite often, from a story perspective, when I'm pairing the two up against each other, the sequel ends up being inferior to the first Gladiator. And so I wasn't caught up in the story. I had a big problem with just not getting enthralled in the journey that Paul Mescal's character is going on. And, I think we're going to talk about Denzel and how good he is in the part. He is really good. But I think that he was so much better than everybody else in it that anytime he wasn't on the screen, I was kind of like, can we get back to his character? Because the rest of it's not really doing anything for me. So I'm somewhere on a 5 scale. I'm between like a 3 and a 3.5. I still think if you're interested in it, you should go see it on the big screen, because I mean, whatever this cost, It's all up there on the screen. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we see these sword and sandal films and they look a little chintzy or they look green screeny. This does not. This looks like Ridley went to the extremes to stage these battles. I just found the story a little bit lacking. So I left the theater a little bit disappointed in what they delivered.
Yeah, I'm a little more positive than that, but I agree. I'm at a 4 out of 5. And okay. So my whole perspective on this is to manage your expectations going in because it's not the first movie. I mean, the first movie is also one of the greatest examples of necessity as the mother of invention. They had hardly any script written when they went to shoot that film for the first time. Like all those famous lines, strength and honor, all that stuff was done during production. Like Russell Crowe gave me, like, I remember during the pandemic, I was interviewing him for that Road Rage film. And I asked him, I have my Gladiator ticket or whatever. And he gave me this 8-minute answer, literally walked me through the whole production process of the first movie and all those things, strength and honor. Are you not entertained? All that stuff came about like naturally through the production process.
He also had an actor die in the middle of production.
I didn't know that.
Oliver Reed.
Did they really?
Oliver Reed died in the middle of filming.
Right. Yeah.
I forgot about that.
That's right.
And so to recreate, it's like, I hate saying this cliche, but lightning in a bottle, like you really can't capture that again. And you're not wrong when you say Gladiator 2 is basically a retread of the first one, but I did dig the emotional aspect of Lucius returning, wanting to take vengeance. I also thought Pedro Pascal's character was fascinating because this character is, obviously he's dedicated to Rome, but he understands the problematic nature of the emperors. Mm. And so I thought that was a cool push pull, and the Connie Nielsen section of it as well. Denzel is great.
Well, you got to admit this movie bends itself in a pretzel trying to connect to the first movie.
100%. I mean, it's and that's one of the things, like, is he really the son? I mean, and it is obviously confirmed through the trailers and the movie itself, but you do have to take a leap.
The way that they try to connect the dots, there are chunks of dialogue that you'll see that where they try to connect the dots. And I was like, well, you should have left that out. It's more confusing.
So, I mean, in my opinion, I think I think it's worth seeing. I actually dug the film for the most part. I do think it's a bit clunky at times. Some of the pacing feels a little strange. I don't think Paul Mescal's character gets the full star power arc that Russell gets.
Right. Well, it makes me wonder if he's just not Gladiator. If he's a star.
He's like good. He's an incredible actor. I just don't think he has that. Like, I didn't leave Gladiator. When you watch the first Gladiator, Russell Crowe is the star. He is Gladiator. He is the guy in that film.
Yeah. I haven't seen it, but one of the differences is that he's acting opposite Denzel Washington and Crowe is acting opposite.
Joaquin was a great scene partner in the first one. I think these are pretty impossible standards to set though. Maximus is the role for which Russell won his Oscar, Gladiator was a Best Picture winning behemoth. Like,
well, this begs the question of is a sequel necessary? That's where this comes down to.
That's my big level. It's unnecessary. I didn't.
Okay,
think
but here,
after
here,
seeing
here's,
it, I didn't think it was necessary.
But I here's while it. While I will argue that for me, I felt like the film was a success. Is that okay? Is it as good as the first one? No, it does not touch the first one. But we often talk about expectations. Like, I never really expected it to. Like, for a movie that 2 years ago I did not really think needed to exist, I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought it was a lot of fun. You know, Sean and I had a nice chat last night on the phone whenever he was driving home from the screening. And yes, there are things that I nitpick about it. Kevin, I'm probably right there with you at about a 4 out of 5.
Yeah.
For me, my biggest nitpick being that there is a line in the first movie where Maximus says that his son is the same age as Lucius. I think he says, how old is your boy? And she says 8. And he goes, my son is nearly 8. Mm-hmm. So by all accounts, that means that the only way that Lucius is his son is if he cheated on his wife, who he spends a majority of the first act of the film trying to get back to. So right. just the whole that is always going to forever be weird to me, like trying to force a thing that Connie Nielsen told me in at the junket that in her mind Lucius was always Maximus's son. Okay, I don't know, but and beyond you
know
that, what?
And we know that Ridley is not someone who gets caught up in details.
No,
right?
Exactly,
like,
exactly.
So I think if you asked him, he would be like, "Bugger off! I don't really care."
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's be honest. If I asked him, he wouldn't answer the question. But still, I thought it was we often talk about factors that go into putting movies on our top 10 list, and I'm not saying this is going to be on my top 10 list, but like for me, just the theatrical experience is a big part of it, and it is. A hell of a theatrical experience. It is an incredible, I remember Kevin last year when you and I were in Rome and took that tour through the Colosseum, and they talked about flooding the Colosseum to have naval battles. I remember thinking, why the hell didn't they put that in Gladiator? Like Jesus. Yeah. And we get to see that. We get to see that. Cool. And we get to see rhinos and we get to see
sharks.
I was gonna say, remember the monkeys. Not everything about the monkeys that they told us, but we get to see the monkeys. To a certain degree in this one. Like there's some truly incredible things that we just get to see, which to me justifies this movie's existence. Like if the justification has to come from it being as good as the first one, then no, it fails. But for me, the justification is, did I go and enjoy it and have a hell of a good time? And it is fun. Such a cliche, but it really is one of those, like, they don't make movies like this anymore. Right.
It's a crowd pleaser. It's a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, it is. I had a hell of a time. And I'm going to tell you, without giving it away, that last shot got me. The last shot left me in the feels.
I like the last shot, too. Yeah. And I also think I this is the kind of movie that will have an A cinema score. Like, people are going to walk out feeling good.
Yeah.
Because meaning that, like, what I mean by that is you're gonna walk out feeling like you had a cinematic experience.
Yeah,
It feels like a blockbuster. It feels like it's worth your money, and that's kind of where I'm at with Jake too. It's like when I give it a 4 out of 5, it's like do I love the film? No, but I really really enjoyed it. But I also had to sit there during the movie and go.
But here's the one thing that I have been a little concerned about, because Kevin and I we saw it about a month ago for the junket.
Yeah.
I haven't really thought much about it since I saw it. Like, same. I saw it, really dug it, did the junket in late October, and then kind of moved on with my life.
Same.
And it's really not up until just the past few days as we're gearing up for the release of the film that I've kind of had to start bringing it back up into my memory and going, wait, okay, what did I like about that? Like, I haven't really thought much about it.
And to your point, like, the movie that keeps coming back to me, the two are Conclave and Anora. Like, I keep thinking about those movies constantly, and I'm like, Anora, I think about Anora every day. I think that I think that film is brilliant. And like, to Jake's point, like Gladiator 2 was a fun, it was almost like, you know what I would equate it to? It's a good roller coaster.
Sure.
Like, when I get off a roller coaster, I was like, oh, that was freaking awesome.
That was great. But then your eye is already to what's the next ride we're going on.
Right.
And you know, so, I will say, and this isn't necessarily meant to be a transition to our next point of conversation, a movie that has surprisingly stuck with me more than I thought it was going to be, it was Wicked.
Well, yes. Keep going
move.
But at some point, I want to put a thumbtack in Anora, because we haven't discussed it at all on the show.
It is.
And the three of us have seen it, and I think we're going to have to have a conversation about it. Not today. Today is reserved for...
5 out of 5.
I loved Wicked. I'm finding myself a little bit more forgiving of my nitpicks, because I do have some. I do think that Wicked is 20 to 25 minutes too long. Yes. I can pinpoint two entire musical sequences that you could just and move on, and I really don't think it would miss them.
We discussed them after we saw
it. Yeah. That being said, damn. I mean, this is a movie going four quadrant pleasing experience, where you just go, John Chu was, and I'm sure he's going to want to do other things with his career after this. But I mean, talk about a man who was born to make a certain type of movie. Mm-hmm. You go back to even like the Step Up films, which use a lot of the same skills that he used here. I was a massive fan of In the Heights and was so genuinely bummed whenever that movie didn't do what it was, what it should have done. But I'm glad that people are finally going to be able to see. Yeah, it's everything about this movie just works. And here's what I'll say, and then I'll let you guys take over. It, even though it's split into a two-part thing, an act one and act two, it very much feels like a complete movie.
Yeah.
Like yes, there is a giant to be continued title card after the big show-stopping number, literally show-stopping number, because it stops the show.
It's massive. It is so big. To be continued. It screams.
There's a big to be continued. But but it didn't quite feel like a, Kevin, what you often describe, like the Spider-Verse movies, where you feel like you're seeing a chapter of a big. To me, I feel like you get your money's worth with this movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 100%. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes. Yes. I mean, the movie is longer than the stage or the stage show. Around that time period. But to Jake's point, though, a lot of the movie has a beginning, middle and end arc. Mm-hmm. Each character has an arc. It's almost like
Infinity War.
That's a good way to put it. Or a TV show season broken into two parts.
Yeah.
You get enough, but you want more.
Yeah. And when Elphaba said all that for a drop of blood, goosebumps. It was great.
I did like when she said Ozzians assemble. That was really that was like one of the best parts of the whole movie.
But I found it strange when she looked at the camera and went, You get it? You get the reference?
I called Jake on the way home from my screening for Wicked. This is a new tradition now. I called Jake because he's an hour behind me. He's on Central Time.
I thought you were gonna say he's always home.
He's always
tag team. Me into those calls. I want to be on those calls. I'm jealous.
You're a busy guy, Kevin.
two of those calls, and Kevin's gonna go, I'm good, actually.
No, I take it back. Next time you do that call,
you did miss a great monkey thumbs up joke after Gladiator.
Oh, that was really funny. I'll tell you afterwards. Yeah, it's kind of spoilery. The monkey thumbs up is spoilery. I called Jake immediately after Wicked and I said that movie's winning Best Picture. Does that mean that I think it's the best movie I've seen this year? No. But it checks every single box that you would want in a Best Picture winner. It is, as Jake said, a four quadrant, crowd pleasing, swing for the fences, and it does everything right. The way I described it is a triple, right down the middle that pleases everybody. And Kev, you talk about coming out of Gladiator, you come out of Wicked away because of where it ends. The end of Act One is essentially the end of the first part of the movie, so you end on Defying Gravity, and it's the showstopper of the thing.
It's the best song in the whole musical, weirdly
and they
enough,
just nail it. They nail it. You cannot emphasize enough how talented those two women are. Mm-hmm. Perfect for these parts.
Okay, let me ask you this. Not this Oscars, but next Oscars, aren't they introducing the casting category?
Oh, are they really?
I think that's the new category that they announced that they're I think casting is one of them.
Over stunts? They haven't done stunts yet.
And but I think casting? You could have made a really solid case. You could have just for Wicked, you just point at Cynthia and Ariana and go, boom, casting Oscars.
What John does in this movie is he made a film like old school Hollywood. It felt like Singing in the Rain, type of like Ariana Grande is that type of movie star. Cynthia Erivo is that type of movie star. These are movie stars that you would have had in that golden age of Hollywood era.
It also would have fit well with Wizard of Oz.
Right. And there's to me what I love about the film is the intimate moments. There's facial expressions that Ariana does and Cynthia do that are remarkable. And I remember, because I've said this before on the show, and this I remember hearing this when you're watching this movie is so in camera, and a lot of what you're seeing and the live singing has such a massive impact on the immersion that you feel in a film like this, because there's sometimes the lip sync takes me out so much. And I guess lip sync's the wrong word, because generally speaking in musicals, the actor is singing on set and then they take the recording and they drop it over it. So you could, the big telltale sign of somebody really singing is if you see their throat moving, as they're singing.
But, and you want it to be the best possible version. Oh, you do. Right. You want it. Yeah. You want the quality to be there. So if they're,
but Cynthia is flying while singing Defying Gravity.
Have you seen those videos of her when she has this thing around her waist,
right,
which affects her, you know, like, right. Imagine like trying to sing the best you can, but you've got this thing that's pressing on the inside.
Right, she's on the broom, flying on wires, singing those songs live. And it's like, and so, but at the end of the day, like, you know, there's a couple things I want to point out. Alice Brooks, who shot this movie, is a genius. She shot In the Heights. She is remarkable, an incredible DP. And Nathan Crawley, who did the production design of the film, did a lot of Nolan's movies. So a lot of this stuff, there's a library sequence in this movie, Dancing Through Life, where they have like this spinning aspect in the library, which is very Kubrick. 2001, it felt like. But that's all like that's happening in camera. I mean, these guys, the Jonathan Bailey. Jonathan Bailey, like the physicality of that character, it's incredible.
When they first get to the Emerald City, I mean, we look at these things and think like, is this a set? Is this a stage? Is this like how it? And the way that they shoot it makes me think that they had like houses upon houses stacked together that they could shoot in, because it just it expands forever. And it doesn't look green screening. It doesn't look digital. It looks like they built these locations.
The train, which is a 90-second sequence in the movie where they have to catch a train to the Emerald City. They built the train.
Yeah.
And,
also,
and you know, that, you like see... every other movie would have just been like a little set that they hop up on and then they green screen the train around. They built this freaking train for a 90-second sequence.
I don't know if I had this right, but I heard the Wicked production budget for the first one is I'm reading 145 million.
Yeah, I would say I heard 150.
That's pretty good for what that looks like.
Because it's incredible.
I haven't seen Red One yet, but Red One cost $250 million. And from the trailers, it just looks so CGI heavy. So I can't speak to the whole film.
You have to take into account that Chris Evans, Dwayne Johnson, JK all probably cost more as actors than Cynthia Erivo, Ariana Grande.
The Red and Red One title, Red One's title is their
budget.
It's their accounting.
But I also want to, Jonathan Bailey, I know, because Cynthia and Ariana are incredible. I think Jonathan Bailey's remarkable. I didn't love Goldblum.
He was a little too Goldblum. I was sort of hoping.
The only thing.
I was sort of hoping that we would have gotten a little bit more of a sinister. I mean, I feel like he kind of plays him a little bit like a carny, a carnival guy, you know,
a little
bit.
Yeah.
But it's, I agree with Kevin in that. I was like, oh, look, there's Goldblum being Goldblum.
His song wasn't that good. I didn't think he hit that as well.
So I want to emphasize two things. One, Kevin's exactly right. The songs are big. They're as good as you expect them to be. It's the in-between moments that sell the movie for me. It's the acting that both Ariana and Cynthia do in the in-between that gets me. That when you watch Cynthia in this particular scene where she shows up at a dance wearing her hat for the first time.
Yeah. The hand on the face
is devastating.
That is that's the best scene in the movie. The dance scene is the best scene in the film.
Devastating.
Yes.
And also I got to go to one of the paid sneaks. We didn't have a screening here in Charlotte. So Monday night they had something set up for Amazon Prime subscribers that you could get an early ticket. And Michelle and I went. And when I tell you guys, and I'm not saying it's gonna be like this everywhere, it was an event. Like our crowd broke into applause after almost every number. Like
it happened in ours.
They were just.
Yeah.
I mean, this has the potential to be massive.
Does it make a billion?
The fact that AMC is having to tell people you can't come and sing during the movie.
Yeah.
Like we're doing a separate sing along, but you cannot come. Like, do you guys see that? AMC made that statement about you guys can, like, the fact that they're having to tell audience in advance, keep your shit together.
I think a billion's out of reach. And I think it does a billion. This is why.
I think it is a billion.
But okay, does it have that worldwide appeal?
The only films that have made a billion musicals are Disney animated films. Beauty and the Beast, Lion King, things like that. I don't think, and what the example I told Jake is Greatest Showman, and he's right, it started slow, but it eventually played for weeks upon weeks, got to like 476 million.
But Wicked
worldwide.
Is a global phenomenon.
It is. I know. It is.
It's made $6 billion or something on stage.
No, I know. I think a million's out of reach, but still, I don't know if that's a fair goal for Wicked, you know? Like, I think a billion is reserved for...
I think if it opens to, and they're saying it's going to, if it opens to 100, you have to keep in mind, the biggest opening weekend for... Yeah. Do you guys know what the biggest opening weekend for a Broadway to movie adaptation is?
Probably like 40, if 40.
30, a little like 30, 31, 32 for Into the Woods. Wicked is probably going to do $100 million this weekend.
A lot of those movies start slow. They open in December.
Yeah.
They're for awards consideration. They expand in January, February.
Yeah. Do you guys, I feel like Wicked is overshadowing Gladiator.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
Like in a big way.
But also, I also think that the audience for Gladiator is also a little bit old. Like my dad really wants to see Gladiator. He's not going to be online talking about it. I think that, you know,
I just don't feel the buzz. I don't feel a buzz for Gladiator.
I mean, they're saying 60-65, which would be huge openings for.
Yeah,
that's the biggest R-rated opening of all time. That's Ridley's biggest opening. Biggest Denzel?
Oppenheimer opened to 80 something.
No, biggest November R-rated opening.
Oh, November.
Yeah. Oh, come on. Let's stop putting all these parameters on.
Well,
listen.
It's like four layers of filters there.
I think Wicked is in Barbie territory.
It could be.
That's how big I think Wicked is. I feel Wicked has that. It has that.
Yeah.
It has that vibe. There is a huge. Everyone's talking about it.
There's no real competition.
Okay, Moana 2.
Moana 2 is going to be big. Okay, but you know, here's what I'll say. Here's why I don't think Glicked is Barbenheimer. This is going to sound like a very specific thing.
But Gladiator's not Oppenheimer. That's the difference.
I'm not seeing the fan art. Remember how much fan art there was about Barbie and Oppenheimer? Like, I'm not really seeing. I've seen a couple of fan-made posters for Glicked that combine the two movies.
Of Wicked stuff on TikTok. I'm saying a lot of fan-driven stuff on TikTok.
Yeah,
people. Wicked is
that's
Barbie.
Where I'm plugged in.
Wicked's Barbie, but Gladiator's not Oppenheimer. I think that's the biggest difference.
That's fair.
I don't think that Gladiator has the Oppenheimer effect.
Sure.
That was given. I mean, listen,
Kev, does it warm Ridley's heart to be compared to Oppenheimer?
No. I don't think so at all. I think we're talking. This is going to be it's going to be a very healthy box office weekend, regardless. Gladiator will play well. It'll run well. But I do think Wicked is approaching the Barbie level of breaking into. Transcending just the movie itself.
Well, they're both long, too. That's going to factor into their
thing.
It is becoming that movie where I think a lot of people are going, well, shit, I didn't really have a lot of interest in seeing it, but now I feel like I got to see it because everyone's like talking to it. Now I feel like I have to see it.
Yeah. I have like on my Instagram video with Cynthia and Ariana, it's like 300 comments or something like that. And like half of them are, I wasn't planning on seeing this movie and now I'm going to go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll continue to track the success of those films as we get into them. In the meantime, we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Like I said, we got some really exciting things coming up.
Are we doing a show next week on Thanksgiving?
Oh, no, we're not. We have a week off, Gabe. Is that right?
Yes. But there will be interviews that publish.
There'll be content next week.
There'll be two interviews.
Whoa.
With varying faces from this panel.
Wow. Is Farrelly Brothers next week?
Yes.
Ooh.
Yeah, I think so.
TBD.
Right.
More as this story develops.
I shouldn't be asking Gabe these questions during the show.
I have it written down, and then I let it stay written down, Kev. So
this was a good episode, guys.
Great episode,
as opposed to all the other ones.
Yeah. No, I'm saying like I think I always love when we do a week of the show when it's a big week for movies.
Oh yeah,
because we do a show every week, and not every single week has that blockbuster status.
Yeah, sure.
Like, this is one of those weeks where you justify your job.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense? Like, you know what I mean? Like it's like this is what we. I mean, not that every week isn't important, but this is one of those like. Hell yeah.
As I tell my bosses, because as with you, Kev, we have a lot of big interviews airing on our respective shows this week. And my bosses have made comments like, man, you guys, you're crushing it every day. You got a big, and I always say, okay, remember this when it's the third week of January.
Yeah. Yeah.
To you at home, I say, remember when we're reviewing Den of Thieves 2.
Yeah. Pantera.
Pantera. I didn't realize that was the name of it until the other day. I was like, hell yeah.
I did not realize how excited this show was about that movie.
That the name is what I actually think Den of Thieves, the first one, is actually really good. It's really Gerard Butler might be the most underrated action actor. He is so he is consistent.
What was
the
one? Delivers.
The submarine one was amazing. Hunter Killer, that was really good. And then
I didn't see that one. Greenland, I liked Greenland.
Greenland was amazing.
What was the one really where he played the
Olympus Has Fallen
assassin or whatever? something.
I just
citizen.
Love that he has a career full of movies where you just go, what was the one where he was, did the thing?
It was Law Abiding Citizen, where he like,
Jamie Foxx, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like a Punisher type. Like avenging his family, but he's like a badass. Yeah.
Let's get Gerard Butler on the show.
Oh, I would love to. Dude, he's awesome.
Let's just run through his filmography.
Kev, over under on there being a Dimebag Daryl lick in,
Pantera. Oh, I was when I saw that name, I could not believe it. I'm like, I guess because Pantera means something else besides the band. I think I don't remember what the meaning of it is, but yeah. Right. Anyways,
in the meantime, follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We'll be back next week. Oh, call to action. What are you guys going to see this weekend? Are you doing the full Glicked double feature? Are you choosing one over the other? Which one are you seeing first? Let us know what you're going to go see. Give us your reviews in the comments down below. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you guys next week. I can't say it much longer. Night, bitch.
I'm kidding.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.